Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to this week's Torah portion from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. This message is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoy this teaching. This week's Torah portion is Va'era. It means, "And I appeared." It is from Exodus chapter 6, verse 2 to chapter 9, verse 35. The Haftarah is Ezekiel 28, starting at verse 25, to chapter 29, verse 21. The Brit Hadashah is Romans chapter 9, verses 14 to 24. Let's say a word of prayer before we get started. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe. You are the creator of all things. We thank you and praise you, and I thank you and give you all praise and honor and glory, and ask that you would be in this teaching, not only that, but that you would actually do the teaching, that none of my words would be here. I give you all the honor, glory, and praise for calling me to do this. And I seek your face in making sure that only your words are spoken. Pray blessings on your people today who are keeping the Shabbat all over the earth. In Yeshua's name, amen. Let's start this Torah portion in a little bit different way than normal. Let's go over to Psalm chapter 119 and start at verse 66. Teach me both knowledge and appropriate discretion, because I believe in your commands. Before I was humbled, I wandered away, but now I observe your words. Lord, you are good, and do what is good. Teach me your statutes. The arrogant have falsely accused me, but I will observe your precepts wholeheartedly. Their minds are clogged as with greasy fat, but I find joy in your instruction. It was for my good that I was humbled, so that I would learn your statutes. Instruction that comes from you is better for me than thousands of gold and silver coins. And isn't that the truth? And isn't that exactly what's happening in this Torah portion? The Lord is humbling people. He's humbling his own people, and he is humbling the Egyptians as well. Now, some are going to take this as instruction, and others are going to take this as destruction. I've said repeatedly that the Torah is designed to kill our flesh, but the Egyptians are walking in a religious spirit which is defined as the flesh, doing what it wants to make itself think it is spiritual and connected to God. I'm going to give you a couple of definitions so that you can begin to understand some things about the flesh. The flesh means two things. First, it means the carnal mind with its negative, debauched desires that are against God. And it also means our literal body with its needs, with those instinctual needs for food and sleep and procreation. That's our flesh. Now, attitudes are flesh in our thoughts. An attitude is your flesh in your thought, or and in your emotion as well. Attitudes, or sometimes in the scripture it talks about spirits, you know, we have different kinds of spirits. Well, what that really is those are our attitudes, those spirits. They get embedded in our soul, in our mind and our emotions. They get embedded in our soul because of the experiences we have in the flesh. Out of those experiences we have in the flesh come attitudes that are either positive or negative. I'm going to say something that will shock you. Neither positive or negative attitudes are from the Lord. They are both from ourselves. You see, when we have a negative attitude, we push that away and say that's not what we want because, you know, it doesn't help us get along very well with other people. It might keep us from having a job to support ourselves. And so, you know, out of necessity, we have to get rid of that negative thing. So then we go, well, we need to have positive attitude because the positive attitude helps us to climb the corporate ladder, helps us to become the deacon in the church. It helps us to have people say, oh, isn't that person wonderful? It brings us admiration. Positive and negative attitudes are both not from the Lord. They both come from ourselves. Many people look at the fruits of the Spirit as having positive attitudes. In fact, you look on the internet. I mean, it's equated, the fruits of the Spirit are equated with positive human attitude or positive human spirit constantly. But that is an incorrect way to look at this type of flesh, the emotional and the thinking flesh, our attitudes. The fruits of the Spirit are from the Lord. They don't come from us. It's the Lord living through us. This is why last week I said we need to become the poor in spirit. We need to have our spirit. We need to have that which we call me. Me needs to become little. Me actually needs to disappear. My flesh literally needs to be killed. And we do this by submitting to the Torah and not walking the Torah in a religious spirit, thinking that, well, we're doing this Sabbath thing. You know, we do these feast things. We do this, you know, when I find my brother's wallet, why, you know, I give it back to him because the Torah said to do that. I'm walking in the Torah. No, you're not. You're walking in your flesh. The Torah is the outline. It's the schoolmaster. But once you learn the rules, you learn to walk in the spirit of the Torah, in the fruit of the spirit of the Torah. And the fruit of the spirit is joy, love, kindness, gentleness, faith, compassion, mercy, all those things. You see, that is the fruit of the spirit that is supposed to come from learning the rules that God set up for us to have relationships with other people and for us to have a relationship with Him. You know, we walk within these guidelines, but we do it from His Spirit, which is embedded in the Torah, not in our own spirit. So I wanted to give you those definitions of flesh and attitudes and explain how attitudes, positive and negative, are not from the Lord. Neither one of them are. And it's important for us to understand this in this Torah portion because I'm going to relay this Torah portion to you as if this Torah portion, those Egyptian plagues, have to do with our flesh. See, last week I talked about Moses' flesh and getting control of that beast. You know, in the beast last week in that Torah portion was the donkey that he put his family on to take them to Egypt, you see. He had to control that donkey. He had to, make his spirit small in order to do what he did because the Lord was doing it through him. Moses really wasn't doing it. It was the Lord using Moses as his instrument. So last week I talked about controlling the beast, and we're going to continue on that theme this week. Now in this week's Torah portion, Moses now knows the Lord as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Now he has written about the Lord as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh from the beginning, from Genesis. But just because he wrote about him that way prior to this point doesn't mean that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob knew the Lord as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Moses explains in this book, Exodus, how he came to understand that the Lord is Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And so now he knows the Lord in a way that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did not. So this tells us that in our walk, we gain understanding of the Lord. Now, getting back to the plagues, I also want to give you a different perspective of the plagues. Like, you know, I just now shocked you about the attitudes. I want to shock you about the plagues and tell you that even though they're usually taught as negative events, I want to look at them as a little bit different. I want to suggest and present to you the possibility that these plagues are actually the Lord's mercy. The Lord's mercy to the children of Israel and to the Egyptians. You see, the Lord puts mercy, he hides mercy in the negative situations of people's lives. To those who are his, those negative situations become refinements to further soften and circumcise our hearts so that his laws can be written on our hearts. And to those who are not his yet, these situations are designed to drive them toward him. Why would they need to be driven toward him? Well, you know, at first, the Lord calls people to come to him. Then, when they don't respond, he has to drive them in order to bring people to him. Why does he do that? Because he doesn't want anyone to perish. He doesn't want anyone to suffer that final plague of death. John 3:15 says that whosoever believes in him will not perish, but will have eternal life. He is not willing for any to perish, you see? And so the plagues then become mercy on two counts. It's the mercy in him freeing his people, and it's the mercy in causing others to come to him who are not already his in order to also be free. You see? So there's mercy embedded in these plagues. Just like Pharaoh suffered with the plagues, and so did all the people with him. You know, others around us suffer with our plagues. And sometimes the Lord sets people apart from those who are suffering with plagues, like the Hebrews were. But Pharaoh and the Egyptians represent our flesh as they suffer with the plagues. And we have the choice, just like Pharaoh, who hardened his own heart, or the Lord permitted the Lord Pharaoh's heart to be hardened. You know, in where it says that God hardened Pharaoh's heart, it's a Hebrew idiom meaning that he was permitted. This was a figure of speech being used there, the hardening of the heart. I have explained this in other Torah portions, and so I won't go into it here. The idea, though, is that all along the way, we have the opportunity until the very last plague. And that last plague is final. There is nothing more that can be done once the last plague comes. And so, let's take a look at these signs. Now, there are 10 plagues in one sign. Moses and Aaron did the sign when they first went to meet Pharaoh. That's the first sign. What was that sign? Well, when the staff got thrown down and it turned into a snake or into a serpent. So what is the Lord trying to do here with this sign and then the first three plagues? Well, the first sign is a snake. What is he saying? Garden of Eden, Pharaoh, hint, hint, don't follow in the footsteps of Adam and Eve. You see, in the garden was the serpent. The serpent fooled Eve, and Adam was, went along with Eve's deception. So, who was fooled and who was deceived? Well, I'm not going to speculate who in this Torah portion was fooled and who was deceived. Could be either one, the Pharaoh or the Egyptians. It could be even the children of Israel in some way and at some point had some deception or were going along with the whole thing the way that Adam did. Nonetheless, we see that the Lord is going to give the Egyptians a little lesson about who it is that actually created the earth and what happened. And so the first sign is the serpent, when man decided that they were going to do it their way. And that's exactly what the Pharaoh is doing, right? He is doing it his way. And so thus we have the sign of the serpent to show Pharaoh that he's actually recreating what happened in the Garden of Eden. Then we have the first of the 10 plagues. The water being turned to blood, the frogs, and we have the dust being turned into lice. So now, let's go and look at what it means for the water to become blood. The Lord was showing the Egyptians and the Hebrews who controls the water. They believed that the Pharaoh was the god of the Nile, that he created the water. He was thus their god that they worshipped. And so the Lord was showing them the destruction of that, the destructiveness of that, to believe that anyone but the Lord, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, that was the creator. Blood has a signification of being associated with destruction in this case. It becomes unusable to the Egyptians and to the Hebrews throughout Egypt. I mean, the water in the water pots turned to blood, you see. So the water became useless. It could no longer be used to help them. So the water turning to blood to the Egyptians meant destruction, because they had been throwing the Hebrew babies into that, and so their destruction was upon them. But to the Hebrews, it would have meant redemption. Now, the frogs represent the Lord showing the world who controls both the water and the land, because frogs live in the water and they live on the land. So the Lord is showing them that he is the creator of the water and that he has the ability to control the water and use it to show them that their destruction now has come because of what they've been doing to his people. But he is also going to use the frogs now to show who controls both the water and the land. There is a deity, an Egyptian deity by the name of Heket, who was the frog female deity. And so she had a hand in controlling the water and the land. And the Lord is saying, no, that's me. I'm controlling the frogs. I control the land and the water. Now, you'll notice that the Egyptian magicians were able to turn their staffs into snakes like Moses did. And they were able to make the water also turn into blood, like Moses did. They were also able to make frogs appear, as Moses did. But this now is going to become the end of their ability to duplicate what the Lord is doing through Moses, because it says that they could not make the frogs die. See, Moses was able to make the frogs die. But the Egyptians and the Hebrews now are going to see that man and his religious trickery has an end. So now the Lord is going to take two different people and show them the plagues, and there's going to be two different things going on in Egypt. Up to this point, the Hebrews were probably just, you know, okay, this God does this, the gods of Pharaoh's court do this, same thing, what's the difference? We get that a lot in the world, don't we? One God, another God, or no God, or, you know, it's all the same, right? That deity of those people over there, that God's the same as our God. No. Eventually, you're going to start to see that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is different and is more powerful and is the actual creator of and the keeper of the earth, and that other deity is not. And so when the magicians have stopped being able to duplicate what Moses was doing, that's when the lights start to come on in the Hebrew mind, you see. They're seeing the beginning of the limitation of man's religious reach. So the Egyptians now are going to be separated from the Hebrews. The Egyptians are going to have their own destruction, and the Hebrews are going to be protected from destruction. Now we're going to get the lice. In this plague, the Lord is showing human beings who controls the afterlife. You see, it says in Exodus chapter 8, starting in verse 16, that the Lord said to Moses, "Say to Aaron, stretch out your rod and smite the dust of the land, that it may become lice throughout all the land of Egypt." And they did so. For Aaron stretched out his hand with his rod and smote the dust of the earth, and it became lice in men and beast. All the dust of the land became lice throughout all the land of Egypt. And the magicians did so with their enchantments to bring forth lice, but they could not. So there were lice upon man and upon beast. And so right here we see that now they're not even able to imitate the Lord in bringing forth the plagues. They could bring forth the frogs, but, you know, Pharaoh had to call Moses and say, "Moses, get rid of these frogs," because the magicians couldn't get rid of the frogs. They brought them, but they couldn't get rid of them. And now the magicians are not able even to duplicate the creation of these things. Why is that? Well, it's because the lice coming from the dust represents the dust of the earth. It represents the ashes to ashes, dust to dust, and the afterlife. You see, one of the big things in Egyptian religion was this big hoopla about the afterlife. You know, the Egyptian Book of the Dead and all the deities that control the afterlife. Well, the Lord is saying, no, not so much. I control the afterlife too. I control the water because I made it, and I can turn it into blood and make it a symbol of destruction for you for what you've done to my people. And, I can make frogs, and I know you make frogs, but I'm able to take them away because you're not. And I'm able to tell you through the frogs that I control both the water and the land. And in the lice, I'm telling you that I control the afterlife as well, you see. So this is to the flesh, this is a warning. You see, there's mercy. I know these people are itching and they're miserable with these lice, but the Lord is saying, look, come to me. I am the one who controls the afterlife. Forget this Egyptian thing. Forget this Egyptian idea of a heaven and a hell. You know, I rule the heavens and I rule hell. You know, I'm in control of life and I'm in control of death. I'm the one, you see. Eventually, we're going to find out that a whole bunch of people came out of Egypt with the Hebrews. You know, that mixed multitude, they kind of came out of there because while these plagues were going on, they caught on and they said, oh, there's mercy in this. Wait a minute, I need to just stop doing this religious thing over here and start being with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Moses and Aaron, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, you see. So now we see that he's showing man that who controls what with the lice. And so now the next thing is that we have the flies. But before we get to the flies, I want to tell you that these first three plagues and the serpent sign are they pertain to both the Egyptians and the Hebrews. The serpent was reminiscent of the sins of the Garden of Eden. The water, the frogs, the lice, all pertained to the Egyptians and the Hebrews. The Hebrews suffered with those like the Egyptians did, but here with the flies, now the Lord is going to start to protect his people. You know, they've probably, now that they've seen that the religious practices of the Egyptians cannot duplicate getting rid of the frogs, and they cannot duplicate creating life, and they would have understood the dust to life being as ashes to ashes, dust to dust. They would have understood that symbology a lot better than we do. The lights are coming on for the Hebrews. But the Egyptians, they don't quite get it yet. You know, the Hebrews, they're familiar with Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. They're familiar with him at this point as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And now Moses has brought them this new understanding of, you know, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and they're seeing Moses and Aaron being used by the Lord. So for them, it's a lot easier. The Egyptians have a little further to go before their lights start to come on. And so the flies is that first plague where the Lord separates out his people from the Egyptians. It says in Exodus 8:21, if you will not let my people go, I will send swarms of flies to you and upon your servants and upon your people into your houses, and the houses of the Egyptians will be full of swarms of flies, and also the ground whereon they are. And I will sever in that day the land of Goshen, in which my people dwell, that no swarms of flies shall be there, to the end that you may know I am the Lord in the midst of the earth. So now what the Lord is going to do is he's going to show the Egyptians, hey, I've got some people over here. These are mine. If you want to get away from these plagues, come join my people. That's really what is going on here. You know, it's the killing of the religious spirit in the Egyptians. It's because we've talked in the past about how the Lord is destroying the gods. Well, part of that is to destroy the religious spirit or the religious attitude of the Egyptians and to get them to submit their flesh to him. And part of that submission is shown when they walk out of Egypt with the Hebrews, you see. So he's going to separate the Hebrews. And this will entice the Egyptians to come with the Hebrews. See, there's mercy. I'm telling you, there's mercy in these plagues. Next comes the death of the livestock. Exodus chapter 9, verse 6 says, "The Lord did this thing the next day, and all the livestock of the Egyptians died, but not one of the livestock died that belonged to the Israelites. Then Pharaoh inquired and discovered that not a single one of the livestock of Israel had died, but Pharaoh's heart was stubborn, and he would not let the people go." Now, it's interesting that right here, the use of the word Israel is in these verses, and not the word Hebrew, as some, you know, we do have the word Hebrew used in Exodus. Let's go and see where that word is used. It is first used in Exodus chapter 1, and it's used 6 times in the book of Exodus. And so Hebrew has to do with Jacob, because Jacob is the grandson of Abraham, who is the grandson of Eber. Hebrew of Eber. And so it has to do with your physical descent. It has to do with who you are physically in the world. But Israel has to do with who you are according to God in the world. And so wherever an Israelite is in the world, the Lord can separate that person from the rest of the world. Because Israelite has to do with having killed or being in the process of killing the flesh, and of exhibiting not their own attitudes, their own religious attitude or religious spirit, not their own attitudes gotten out of their physical experiences in life, but being an Israelite is you exhibit the fruit of the Spirit. You exhibit His Spirit. You see, this is different than being Hebrew or being Jacob. We call ourselves Hebrews because we want to identify with being Hebrew, with being a child of Abraham, and rightly so. It's okay to do that. But in this instance, what we're talking about is the difference between being merely a Hebrew and being an Israelite, one that the Lord has set apart. You see, that's what an Israelite is. He's set apart because you have surrendered and submitted your flesh. Now, as I said last week, donkeys and animals generally in the scripture represent our human carnality. They represent our beast. Our flesh is a beast. You know, the man that we call the beast in the book of Revelation, and Nebuchadnezzar, who was a beast, you know, they are men. That beast is nothing more than a man. And why should we be afraid of a man? You know, the book of Revelation scares the critters out of everybody. But it should just be information for us so that we know that, oh, this beast is nothing. This beast does all this stuff, but look what the Lord is doing. And he's just a man. So animals, and like last week's donkey, represents our carnality, our beast. Our beast has to die. Okay? So if we're living as an Egyptian, our beast is still in the process of having to die. But if we're living as an Israelite, our beast should already be dead. You see what I'm saying? So we have here in the death of the livestock mercy, in that the Lord is sending a very clear message about how you actually get close to the Lord. Your beast dies, your flesh dies, your carnality dies, your attitudes, both positive and negative, die in favor of being an Israelite led by the Spirit. I hope that I am not being too wordy about this, but I hope that I'm getting the point across about the attitudes that we need, especially in these end of days with what's coming. It's great for us to learn all the prophecies and everything, but look, you can know the Torah inside and out and still be fleshy, still have bad attitudes, positive and negative attitudes. You can know the prophets inside and out, but if you are not prepared on the inside, it's not going to do you any good. You have to become an Israelite. So now we need to go talk about the boils. The boils represent leprosy. The same word there for boil in chapter 9 is the word for the boils on the leper. In Leviticus 13:18, it describes these boils as being related to leprosy. It says the flesh in which in the skin of it is a boil and is healed, and in the place of the boil, if there be a white rising or a bright spot, white and somewhat reddish, and it be showed to the priest, and if when the priest sees it, it is in a sight lower than the skin, and the hair is turned white, the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It is a plague of leprosy broken out of the boil. So what we have here in this plague of Egypt is we have the beginning of leprosy. There is no description of that there is a hair turned white and coming out of the boils. But nonetheless, these boils are related to leprosy. Now, I wanted to mention this because leprosy has to do with being unclean. Now, the flies represent having to do with that which is filthy, diseased, and contaminated. It has to do with being in need of being cleaned up, healed, and decontaminated. But when there is leprosy, or when there is the danger of leprosy, as in these Egyptian boils, now you are in danger of not being able to come before the Lord because you might be ritually impure. So the children of Israel are separated from and not affected by the flies or the leprosy because especially with the leprosy, they would not have been able to come before the Lord at Passover. You see? You have to, before the priest can say that this is leprosy, you have to be separated out from everyone. And he has to come and inspect you after 7 days, and then, you know, you go through that whole process because there's still, you know, when you first get these boils, nobody knows what it is. You just got to be separated out, and then they come back and they look at it and they look for the hair and all of that. Well, you see, this is where the Egyptians are at this point. They have the boils, but nobody knows whether it's yet leprosy. But we don't want the Hebrews to even be in danger of having leprosy. So the Lord separates them out so that they can be clean for the Passover event, which is going to come. And so the Egyptians are in danger of not being able to partake in that Passover if they find themselves in this ritually impure state. Now, the law of the leper is not yet taught. Now, I don't know. I'm thinking that the whole Torah was given at the beginning of the world, at the foundation of the world. But yet the Lord gives us instructions about this later on in the next book, you see. Yet, there would have been an understanding that you don't come before your God in this condition. And that's another thing, you know. There were states of purification for these people to come before their gods. So even if they were not going to come before Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, they still couldn't come before their own gods. You see? So there is a killing of the flesh going on here in the boils. But there's also something else going on. A boil is a bubble of water next to the epidermis, and that is covered over by skin. And so we've got another water plague here. Now, water without the Lord, you know, water that is attached to the flesh, becomes pain, and it's useless. Water that has blood, or water that has been turned to blood, is useless. So we have this second water now that is useless because it's attached to the flesh. You might think that the water that's attached to you is good water, but it's not. It's a boil. You know, your own fleshy creation of religious spirit that you have is shown to us in this boil, you see? Now, let's go to the hail. The significance of a rain of hail has to do with the falsities that come from evil, which destroy the truth, and they destroy faith. Now, rain, of course, is a blessing, but hail is a curse. Hail is hardened rain. It also is water that is useless to us. It's His Word and His Spirit that are come, but they're useless to us because they're hardened. Hail also destroys planted crops. And I'll have more to say about that in just a minute when we get to some more about the crops. But I want to continue on with the understanding of the plagues being full of these water signs and symbols, because water is the symbol of the Lord. But when it comes to us in a negative way, as in it's turned to blood, that means destruction. Hail, that's hardness. And boils is your religious attitude with, you know, the water stuck on your body. The meaning is that when we put ourselves as the God of our lives, the water becomes a danger to us. It means that the Lord then is our enemy. In Romans chapter 8, verse 7, it says, because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be. So we need to understand the meaning of these three different ways that the Lord uses the waters to plague the carnal man, the Egyptian man in us. Now let's go to the locusts. Locusts represent torturous situations and conditions that come to our lives, but they signify waste and wastefulness in our lives. You know, they signify those years of our lives that we have not lived for the Lord. Those years or days or weeks or months, they're wasted. They're literally eaten by locusts. Now, we have the power to eat locusts like John the Baptizer. In Matthew chapter 3, verse 4, it says that John he was eating locusts and wild honey. In Mark 1, verse 6, it says the same thing, that John ate locusts and wild honey. So how do we eat the locusts? Well, we make every day count for the Lord so that it does not become a waste. What the Lord was telling the carnal man, the Egyptian man, is that when you're not serving me, your life is being wasted. You see? But I want to kind of go off this track for a minute and get into some prophecy about the locusts. Proverbs chapter 30, verse 27 says, "The locusts have no king, yet they go forth, all of them, by bands." You know, the caliphate that is trying to be set up on earth yet, they have a leader, they claim. You know, this guy that says he leads them and gives them commands of what to do, but he is not a king. He may be their leader, but he is not a king. But if you'll notice what ISIS does on the earth, I believe they're the locusts. They go forth by bands, don't they? They do a band of them over here, and they destroy Sweden and Paris, and you know, they go over here, and they destroy in New York and California, and they go over there to Germany, and they go down into Nigeria, and they destroy. You see, little bands of these locusts go everywhere, and they go without a king, yet somehow they know to go. In Revelation chapter 9, verses 3 and 7, it says, "And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth. To them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. The shapes of the locusts were like horses prepared for battle. On their heads were, as it were, crowns like gold, and their faces were as the faces of men." That's because these are men. But in the end of days, they have the power of locusts to sting. You know, we have missiles that sting, right? I'm not going to get all into that, but I thought it was interesting that we're going to have this plague of locusts again, only it's... And they're going to waste things. You see, this is what ISIS does. They waste things, and their lives are wasted. They have this religious spirit called jihad, and they think that they're doing God's will. This is the extreme epitome of a religious spirit. This spirit in ISIS is even worse than Pharaoh and the Egyptians, you see. Okay, I want to get back to hail that destroyed the planted crops, because now we're going to see that locust destroys everything else, right? Isn't that what it says in Exodus? Yes, now I know that I'm going beyond this week's Torah portion, but I want to continue with these plagues so that we get them all in one teaching. In Exodus 10:15, it says, "They," that's the locusts, "covered the face of the whole earth, so that the land was darkened, and they ate every herb of the land and all the fruit of the trees which the hail had left, and there remained not any green thing in the trees or in the herbs of the field through all the land of Egypt." By the way, going back to the locusts in the book of Revelation, it says that you know, they were not given the power to touch the green things. In Revelation 9:4, it says, "And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, nor any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads." So these are not locust insects. These are they're not going to eat up the things, the fruit of the earth and all the leaves and all the things that locusts normally do at the end of days. But the significant thing here about what happens with the hail, which destroys the planted crops, you've got some things left after the hail is done, right? You've got maybe some, you know, fruit on the trees. You might have some edibles, right? You go in the forest and there's some edible greens that were left when the hail, because the hail came down on the leaves of the trees and maybe didn't destroy all the wild edible things, right? But now the Lord brings the locusts so that we can't go, "Oh, well, I'll just go on out there and I'll save myself. I'll go eat the fruit. I'll go eat the wild edibles," you see. Nope. When the Lord decides he's going to drive you to him, or he's going to make you decide to not come to him, he's putting you in that position of making a decision. He's going to make it look so bad over there that you're going to want to come to him, because there's food in Goshen. You know, he's going to The children of Israel have food. He's going to make them comfortable. You're the one that's uncomfortable. It is only your hard heart, which, by the way, you know what that is? It's a religious spirit, as I have been saying throughout this Torah portion. It's a religious spirit that says, I am going to do this my way. And you become so stubborn and so hardened that even though he calls you, you no longer can respond, you see. And so he's going to take away everything so that you cannot have any chance of doing things your own way. And yet if you continue along that path, well, then he's got more for you. And the next thing that he does to you is he puts you in darkness. Darkness means literally separation from the light. All of man's religious practices and rituals involve light. And still, in today's world, all religions use candles in their religious rituals. Now, candles are a very dim light. And, you know, you put a candle outside in the sunlight, it doesn't do any good, right? So it's a very dim light, yet men call a candlelight the light. So the Lord puts them in total darkness in order for them to begin to crave the light. But the light that he wants our flesh to, not our flesh, that he wants our souls to crave is his light, which is the real light. The darkness, which is what our flesh is, by the way, the darkness cannot know the light. So common sense would say that a person would want the real light once they have experienced the darkness. But again, the problem with our flesh is that the flesh needs darkness in order to operate. Why does the flesh need darkness in order to operate? It's because the flesh is opaque. The light cannot pass through that darkness of the flesh. It passes through the light, but it does not comprehend that it is passing through the light. You see? Flesh, again, let me tell you what flesh is. I gave you the definitions earlier, but let's go back over that. The flesh is the carnal mind with its negative and debauched desires that are against God. It's also our attitudes, both positive and negative, that get embedded in our souls because of the experiences we have in life, you see? So our physical flesh and our attitudes are literally what I'm talking about here. That they cannot, our flesh or our attitudes, positive and negative, are opaque. They cannot understand the darkness. They can't comprehend the darkness. The darkness cannot pass through our fleshy attitudes, whether they're positive attitudes or negative attitudes, because our flesh's attitudes come from us. We have to give ourselves up. You see, I don't know how else that I can say it to make you understand. I hope that you do understand. Light cannot pass through your attitudes. Light cannot pass through your body. They pass through the light, but they don't comprehend. So literally, this is why we have to kill our carnal minds, our flesh, our negative and positive attitudes. If we fail to be driven home to the Lord, if we fail to kill our Egyptian flesh, then all that is left of us to become is a dead firstborn. You see, we're all supposed to be firstborns. When we come to Yeshua to be born of the Spirit, we become a firstborn. We're all supposed to be firstborns. And so, if we reject that, we just become a dead firstborn, someone who was supposed to gain life and be resurrected at the last day, but who failed to obtain eternal life because they thought that their life was within themselves. They did not see that life comes from the Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Our life does come from Him. And when we see that, our life begins to change. And not only does it change, but then the light shines out from us. So now, with our flesh gone, we become light. You see? And we don't have to suffer the death of the human firstborn. I hope this Torah portion has been a blessing to you. Give all honor and praise to the One who makes it possible to understand these things. Shabbat Shalom.